Thank you, guys. Thank you for following Sammer's instructions. It makes it a little easier to get up here. Who in here won the pumpkin spice latte? You are my people right here on the front row. And it is true, my family is hitting up Susto Taco Bar just after this service. I promise you that. Something else that's true that I didn't put in the video this morning is that 6 years ago, my family moved from the beach to Georgia. Most of my friends in Georgia have a really hard time understanding why we would move from the beach. Who in here has heard of Panama City Beach? Ah, the laughs. Okay, some of you just went back to spring break 1999, didn't you? If cruising the strip means something to you, meet me in the rotunda and we'll swap stories later. Good old arrive on vacation, leave on probation, Panama City Beach. That's right. As much as we love the beach, Florida also comes with these pesky storms called hurricanes. In fact, you've probably seen the catastrophic damage of the most recent hurricanes that got a little too close to comfort for my family. Because in 2018, my family survived a Category 5 hurricane, Hurricane Michael. It is said to be tied with Katrina as the third most intense storm to have ever hit the United States. And while my family, being Panama City natives, we chose not to evacuate. And so I remember waking up that morning to the news that Hurricane Michael had now upgraded from a Category 3 to a Category 4, eventually making landfall as a Category 5 hurricane. And I remember sitting in my parents' living room that morning, looking out the window, watching trees snap one by one, closer and closer and closer to us. And then this huge motorhome down the road was rocking back and forth, eventually flipping over on its side. And then all of a sudden, a porta potty flew by the window. You know you're in Panama City if a porta potty flies by the window during the hurricane. And that's when the winds began to sound like a freight train. And we knew at that moment, it was like a scene from the movie Twister. We had to go to our safe room. And so my dad, my husband, my mom, myself, my two children, we jumped up to run to the interior closet of their main bedroom, and that's when the front door blew open. The winds were so strong. My dad and my husband, they were left behind to try and hold the door closed, eventually boarding up from the inside of the house. And I remember sitting in the closet that day with my mom and my two children, and things were falling on us from the top shelf. I genuinely thought the house was going to implode. You can imagine how terrified we truly were. And everyone handles these things differently in a crisis. My family would tell you, I am not your girl in a crisis. You do not want me with you in a crisis. There is a level of crazy that comes out that is hard to explain. My poor husband could tell you that. But there we sat, my saint of a mom. She was sitting on her stool in the closet, and she's singing hymns over my two children and praying prayers over my son and my daughter, one of which was sick. The other one was yelling, I don't want to die. And in those moments, you do what you have to do, right? She looks at me, and then there I sit. I'm curled up in the corner of the closet, crying, shaking. I'm pretty sure I also was yelling, I don't want to die. And my mom reaches in her purse. And to this day, I have no idea why my mom had her purse in the closet with her. But there she sat. I don't know where she thought we were going, but she was prepared. She sat on her stool. She reaches in her purse, and she pulls out the emergency Xanax. Now, I don't know about you. Most people in the storm would have a bottle of water, maybe a granola bar, maybe a loaf of bread, some peanut butter. But my mom, she had the emergency Xanax. She pulls it out, and with the most mom-like look, and you know what I mean, she's looking at me, and she says, take the Xanax. And I was like, I'll be okay. She said, take the Xanax. It's the lowest dose. It'll take the edge off. It'll help you breathe. So I did what any good mom would do. I took the Xanax. Now, a side note to that is a few months later, when the kids got back in school, the teachers, in a way to help our kids process what happened in the storm, they had to draw their experience from the storm. And my little son, who's in the second grade, he drew my mom and her purse, myself, my daughter, and himself in the closet that day. And at the top of the paper, he wrote, "My mom took 5 Xanax." Z-A-N-E-K-S, Xanax. You can imagine that phone call that I got that day. "Yes, Miss Weeks, I'm okay, I promise. It was just one." And if all of that wasn't enough, the carbon monoxide alarm started going off. Can you believe this? It was like the perfect storm. And in that moment, no amount of Xanax could have kept this mom calm. And in what felt like forever, but it was only just a little while, I remember hearing my husband say, "You can come out now." And so what did I do? Well, I jumped up, I grabbed the kids, and that's when crazy mom mode ensued. And if you're in here and you have kids, you probably know what crazy mom mode means. You have sudden hearing loss, sudden vision loss. You're only thinking, "Save my kids." And so that's what I did. I grabbed the kids, I run to the closest window, I throw open the window, I literally had their heads out the window, and I'm yelling, "Breathe, breathe, breathe." And that's when I hear this little voice, and I look up, and there stands my husband on the other side of the window, and he says, "The storm stopped. You can come out now." All we had to do was walk outside to safety. I was so focused on the chaos of what was happening right in front of me, I couldn't see what was happening beyond that. Have you ever been there? Have you ever found yourself unable to see a way forward because of the chaos happening around you? I mean, you may not have been through a literal hurricane, but we all endure our own storms, both big and small. It's simply part of the human experience. And this isn't a faith thing. It's not a Christian thing. This is simply a human thing. We all struggle. We all suffer. In fact, you may be in a season even now of struggle. Where are my ladies in your midlife? That's all I have to say, really. I'm going to talk to you for just a moment. I call this our double spank season, where no amount of air conditioning can cool us off, and you're enraged by your husband's breath. Or maybe you just added your teenager to the car insurance, and you're trying to figure out how to take out a second mortgage to pay that monthly bill. Or maybe your garage door broke and your hot water heater broke on the same day, and then you're driving to church and you get a ticket for holding your cell phone. And that's just what's been going on in my life right now. But you have them too. The everyday trials of life. Or maybe your current struggles are much heavier. And you're thinking, "I would wear double Spanx any day if I didn't have to go through what I'm going through right now." Maybe you're facing job loss, a betrayal, financial worries, relationship challenges, a divorce, a health diagnosis, or maybe the loss of a loved one. These are the unwelcomed, yet inevitable, storms of life. And it's a tension that we all feel. We wish it wouldn't happen, but you know that it will. And when they hit, it can be impossible to see a way forward. It can feel hopeless, like there's no end in sight. But what if I told you today there's a way to go through your storm? And there's a way to go through your storm to not only survive it, but there's a way to go through your storm that could potentially make you better. The way through the storms of life is dependent on one thing. And that one thing is a choice. And that choice can change everything. And I want to talk about that choice today. Because the reality is that we're all faced with choices, with how we respond when the storms of life come our way. And the truth is, the default choice for me, and perhaps the default choice for you, and the one that makes the most sense, it's to run. It's to give up. It's to grow bitter and resentful, cynical. It could be the reason that you walked away from your faith, or you're contemplating walking away from your faith even today. And for some of us in this room, we may have felt like we had no choice at all. But I'm standing here because of my own trials. And I've learned and am learning there's a better choice. And so that begs the questions. If the storms of life are going to come no matter what, then how does our faith inform our response? How does it help us to make a choice? How does it help us to see a way through that not only helps us to survive, but has the potential to make us better? And if you're here today and you don't have faith, maybe your storm has forced you here to look at a different response because what you've tried in the past is no longer working. And I want to say, I'm so glad you're here. And my prayer is that you walk out with a little more hope than what you walked in with. Today we're talking about another choice. And we're going to look at the life and the teachings of James. And I believe with practice, the choice James gives us, I believe that can become our default choice. And so here's what he says. Chapter 1, verse 2, he says, "Consider it pure joy, my brothers and sisters, whenever you face trials of many kinds." And I'm going to stop right there. Because I believe if you had shown me this when I walked outside after the hurricane and I saw the total devastation, houses completely gone, not a tree in sight. We couldn't get in touch with our family members. I would have challenged you. I might have been offended by you. Because for some reason, it's more palatable to read, "consider it unfair," or "consider doubting God." It's so much easier responding with bitterness and frustration and anger, because that's the natural response. But James says just the opposite. He says, "Consider it pure joy." And before you think, "I'm done," that's the typical Christian response, be happy in all circumstances. I think you'll see that that's not what he's saying here. I think you'll see that James has some wisdom from his own life experiences. This James is the half-brother of Jesus. But he didn't follow Jesus until after Jesus died on the cross, rose again 3 days later. And then he encountered James post-resurrection. And when he encountered James after the resurrection, that's when James decided, this guy actually is legit. He's not crazy. What he's saying was true. And he committed his life to follow Jesus. And so now here James is, 30 years later, he's been in Jerusalem. And he's been helping build the church. And they've been under tremendous adversity and persecution. There are people losing their lives for their faith in Jesus. So I want you to think about it. This guy, James, has been responsible for a community in crisis for 30 years. And he gives this qualifier. He's saying, "I'm with you, my brothers and my sisters." All of this to say, James isn't writing to us from his penthouse in Jerusalem up above. He's writing to us from boots on the ground, real life, real trials like you and like me. And he's writing to other Christ followers. And he says, hey, I'm in this with you, my brothers, my sisters. He's saying, I know what it's like to be tired. I know what it's like to want to give up. He's saying, but let me help you. Before you give up, before you walk away, he's saying, consider it pure joy. My brothers, my sisters, whenever you face trials of many kinds. He's not saying if. He's saying when. He's saying trials are inevitable. They're not punishment. They're not a curse. You can't pray the trials away. You can't wish the trials away. He's saying trials are going to happen. And when they happen, you are going to have to face them. And so he's saying, go ahead now and decide your response. And respond in a way that allows God to leverage your pain, leverage your trial for good. And so you may be thinking, how do I consider it joy? How do I do that, James? How do you hold both joy and sorrow at the same time? How do you choose joy when life is falling apart? Well, he goes on to tell us in verse 3, he says, because you know that the testing of your faith produces perseverance. He's saying you can be confident in your choice to choose joy because you know that the trial is going to expose the authenticity of your faith. It's really hard to maintain an image when we're in pain. Our image and our reputation is what people see. It's what people think we are. And when life is going good, it's really easy to keep a good image. But our character, what's on the inside of us, our true colors, when life gets hard, our character is exposed. You see, your faith, your commitment, and your integrity are measured by your reaction to pain. And whether we like it or not, James is saying there's actually joy in discovering where our faith is. And if you can take a step back, and you can catch your breath, and you can regain your vision, there's joy to be found, even in your pain. He says, because you know that the testing of your faith produces perseverance. It's producing something in you. Perseverance also means endurance. I found it interesting that the Greek word for endurance is called hupomone. It means staying under the tension. That's what produces endurance, staying under the tension. If you put your faith part aside for just a moment, I think you'll see this to be true in other areas of your life. If you've ever had to pay off debt, or you've ever had to get your health in check, or you've ever gone to school to get a degree, then you know staying under the tension yields the results that you want. Take working out, for example. To improve your endurance, to grow your muscle, you have to experience time under tension. I wish it was a one and done. I wish we could walk in, walk out like a supermodel, but that's not the way that it works. You have to experience time under tension. A while back, I hired a personal trainer, and I went in and I told him I have two goals. I said, I want to increase my confidence in my abilities, and I want to increase my strength. Quite honestly, when I would walk into One Life, where I go to the gym, I would make a beeline up the stairs with my head down to the movie room. It's all dark. I would work out. I would make a beeline back down the stairs to my car, never making eye contact with anybody. And quite honestly, I saw this lack of confidence throughout my whole life. There was a common thread. And vulnerably, I told this trainer that. I said, listen, I want to increase my confidence in my abilities, and I want to increase my strength. And so I came in one day, and he's standing there with a big old grin on his face. And I'm thinking, oh boy, what did I get myself into here? He says, I got a plan. Follow me. And so we start down the middle of One Life on the bottom floor. If you've worked out at One Life, you understand what I'm saying. Very intimidating. Through the middle of One Life, and I'm thinking, oh no. He takes me to the mirror area. The mirror areas where all these big dudes work out and grunt at themselves the entire time while they're looking at themselves. And he puts me right in the middle of all of them. He pulls out this standalone piece of equipment that looks like this. You can imagine the horror. I'm thinking, what the world do you do with that? He says, you put your feet on the pads here and you lean over this bar without your hands. And the motion of leaning all the way over the bar and back up is going to be what increases your core strength and increases your back strength. Well, I'm thinking it's not enough that you put me in the middle of One Life in the mirrors, but you're making me put my backside up in the air in front of everyone. And against my better judgment, I thought, all I'm doing, I've paid this guy a lot of money, so I'm gonna do it. So I get on the machine and I get all the way down. And I lost every ounce of confidence, dignity, and my filter. My legs come out from under me. My arms come out from under me. I am literally teetering on the bar yelling, get me off this thing. And that poor guy is staring at me like, I don't even know what to do right now. And he couldn't get me off of it fast enough. He got me away as quick as he could. And to be honest with you, in the moment, I either was going to fire him or I was running out of the gym, neither of which happened. And once I was able to calm down, call me crazy, I kept coming back every week, every day for more. It took making the decision to stay under that tension. And I eventually yielded the results that I wanted. I walk into One Life now like I own the place, and I'm right in the middle of those dudes grunting with them, working out in front of the mirrors. In the same way, James is saying, for our faith, for our own sake, you may not be able to change your circumstances, but you don't have to give up your hope. You don't have to give in to your feelings. Then he says, let perseverance finish its work, so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything. He's saying there's an outcome here. So don't quit. Don't give up too soon. Let it have its full effect. It's going to make you mature. It's going to make you complete. You will lack for nothing. It's going to produce a stronger faith in you than before. That thing you're trying to pray away could be what's making you stronger. Andy Stanley says it this way. He says, let the tension in our lives, or the tension in our lives, is the epicenter of God's activity in our lives. Let perseverance, let endurance complete its work. Let it all play out, so that you will be complete. And he's not saying you will be grateful for the storm. He's saying you will be grateful for the endurance to withstand the storm. Because chances are you're going to experience God in a way that you may not have experienced when life was going so great. There is something about trials that gives us a glimpse of God's goodness and his grace that we often will not fully grasp when life is good. Making the choice to focus on what is beyond your circumstance is what produces the endurance that keeps you moving forward. It's hope. And you may be asking yourself, how does she know? She doesn't know what I'm going through. But when Samara asked me to speak, it made the most sense to me to speak to you from the pages of my life over the last year. On March the 1st of last year, I walked out of a staff meeting to the phone call from my dad. My mom, who had gone in for a routine procedure, came out with a terminal diagnosis. They said she had cancer. And at the time, they gave her 3 to 5 years to live. We knew the type of cancer that she had a very low cure rate, 8% to be exact. And so it's amazing when you know that, you get 3 to 5 years, how long 3 to 5 years suddenly sounds. And I remember thinking in the moment, God, please, I remember asking God, please give us 3 to 5 years. Please give us the most you could possibly give. I thought, 3 to 5 years, she'll see my daughter graduate high school. She'll still get to see my son get his driver's license. She'll still get to go to the 16th birthday trip we were planning that summer. But by March 8th, they found the cancer had spread aggressively, and they gave her 4 to 6 months. And on March 20th, my mom passed away. And I'll be honest, the pain of her loss was too hard to bear. And I couldn't see a way forward for our family, for myself. I've always heard it said the mom is the glue, and in my case, I found that to be true. And as if that wasn't enough, when we got back from her services and my kids went back to school, my daughter, who was in the 10th grade at the time, she went back to her classes, and the first day back, she's sitting in class and she gets text after text after text, 8 text messages, all at the same time from her friend group. And they had decided that they were no longer going to be her friend. They believed a rumor that was spread while she was gone, and they told her exactly what they thought of her. They cut her out of the friend group. And for those of you that have children, you understand when they suffer, we suffer. And then after that, my dad, just a short while later, went in for a routine procedure, and he had a major complication. And my sister, who was with him, she called me home. She said, I don't know what the outcome's going to be here. He is incredibly sick. So I went back to the same hospital my mom was diagnosed in. And as I'm sitting in the hospital room with my dad, 5 months to the day of my mom's passing, we get the word, my grandma, my mom's mom, had passed away. And all of that, on top of the everyday trials, the financial struggles, the work tension, the marital tension, my own health struggles. And to be honest with you, I had had enough. I couldn't understand why all of these things at one time, all I could see was what was right in front of me, and I felt hopeless, and I felt helpless. I couldn't change any of it, and I've spent the better part of the last year wrestling with God about how I feel, searching for his goodness. And every time I would take God to the mat and begin telling him how I feel, all of my questions, I would remember this one conversation with my mom before she passed away. About a week into her diagnosis, she had a major complication, and they called me home in the middle of the night. They thought that that was going to be it for her. And so by the time that I got there at midnight, they had stabilized her, and the prognosis looked a little differently. And so my dad had gone home to rest, and it was just she and I. We were sitting in the hospital room, and when you get a diagnosis this aggressive, you don't always see doctors in the order in which you should normally get to see them. And so this was the first time the oncologist had come into her room and saw her. And he said, "Miss David, I read your charts, and I'm here to give you a treatment plan. And to be honest with you, the type of cancer you have, the treatment is just not going to extend your life." He said it will only make it harder. And so I would encourage you to spend the rest of your days with your family. And my mom looked at him and she grabbed his hand and she said, "It's okay." She said, "I understand what you're saying, but I will be okay." And the doctor was stunned. He looked at her and he said, "Miss David, people at this stage typically are in denial or they're extremely angry, but you have so much peace. I can't describe it. I can describe it." She spent her life choosing joy in the face of her trials. A lifetime looking beyond her pain. Her faith wasn't in her circumstances. Her heart was fixed on Jesus. Her hope was certain of what she could not physically see. And she didn't stop asking God for a miracle, and neither did we. And I would encourage you, never stop asking for your miracle. But she didn't let what she was facing rob her of the joy that she had in her Savior. She lived her life in such a way, training in her trials, that the endurance she had to finish her race was the inspiration I needed to keep running mine. And this has been my tension over the last year, where God has actively been healing me. The place he's been restoring me and helping me and loving me and growing me. Where is your tension? Where is it in your life? Where is your opportunity to choose joy? I want to leave you with three things today that will help you make the decision to choose joy. The first one is to be honest in the trials. Be honest about how you feel. The feelings that accompany trials are real and valid. Doubt, rejection, insecurity, guilt, shame, worry, rage, envy. But if not expressed, they can cast a long, lingering shadow over your life. So tell God how you feel. Don't mask it. Don't bury it. He can handle it. He welcomes it. I heard a message preached by Tim Keller once, and he said, when we are honest, it cleanses the soul. Grace meets us where we are, not where we pretend to be. So be honest. Number two, remember in the trials, remember what God has already done. Reflect on those giants in the faith that you're inspired by. When life spins out of control, it's so easy for us to go into control mode. But I encourage you to be still and remember. And by the way, either you're walking with someone in pain right now or you're going through it yourself. And I want to offer you two suggestions. Number one, never minimize pain. Get rid of the words "at least." I have a friend who's a young mom who's battled diabetes her whole life. She said that the amount of times people say "at least it's not cancer," it's not helpful. So lose the words at least, and don't rush people. Timelines and grief, they don't work. We all grieve differently. We all grieve at our own pace. And number three, be determined in the trials. Decide now that you may feel all the feels, but you can trust God with the rest. And here's what's true. It is easier to be determined when you are not alone. So don't isolate. Surround yourself with people that can help you stay determined. And today's a great place to start. There are actually people across the hall in our next room whose whole job is to help you find your people, to help you connect here at Woodstock City. So dig your heels in. Stay under the tension. Be determined. Listen, I don't know what your story is. And the longer I live, I'm convinced that most of our lives don't just include pain, they are pain. But here's what I know. I know that God is bigger than your circumstances. God is bigger than what you are facing and will face. And I can stand here and say that because I've learned and I am learning in real time. He is bigger than mine. And I know that when my mom passed away, there were people in my life that had lost their parents before me, and they showed up for me in ways that other people couldn't because they didn't fully understand. They used their pain to help me. And when my daughter lost her friends, her small group leaders here, they rallied. They created a space that was so safe. It brought healing to her life. It gave her confidence. She made new friends eventually. And guess what? She brought them here to that group. She wanted them to understand what true friendship, true Christ-like love really is. And two of those girls were baptized this year, and they now serve in our preschool ministry, Wombaland, every Sunday. I want faith like that. I want faith like my mom, Terry. Imagine what our world would look like if we leveraged our pain to help other people in theirs. Imagine what life could look like if our response to pain pointed people to the hope that we have in Jesus. Imagine if people that lived beyond us said, "My life is better because of how she responded to her trials. My life is richer because she used her pain to help me." So let me ask you, will you choose joy today? Will you trust God in your pain? Will you allow God to do something in you and perhaps even through you when the unwelcomed yet inevitable storms of life come your way? I invite you to today. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, you are so, so good to us. And I'm so thankful today for your love. I'm thankful for your promise to draw close to us when we hurt. Lord, I'm thankful today for the supernatural ability to choose joy. Thank you for your love. Amen.